AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Dodge. And by Henkel, excellence is our passion.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 308 for October 30th of 2015. Pratt & Miller's amazing engineering playhouse. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. I want to welcome everybody to AutoLine After Hours. My co-host, Gary Vasilash, is somewhere out traipsing around the country driving a new Camaro. But we've got two colleagues and friends in the house here. Frank Marcus with Motor Trend Magazine. Frank, great having you here.
Always back. A pleasure.
And Lindsay Brook with SAE International.
Good to be here, John. Thanks.
It's great having the both of you here. And I'm especially glad that you guys are here because we got a lot of good things to talk about, especially... We should let everyone know we've got Lynn Bishop, the Vice President of Engineering Services from Pratt & Miller. Welcome to AutoLine After Hours.
Thank you, John. Pleasure to be here. So we're excited.
We got a lot to talk about, but for those who are not that familiar with Pratt & Miller, or maybe they know you because of your racing activities with Corvette Racing and Cadillac as well, what all do you guys do? It's like you guys get into a whole bunch of different things.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty exciting. We get to do a lot of, you know, really interesting and fun things. As you said, we're most known for our relationship with General Motors and supporting them and success they've had in motorsports. Our Corvette race program, we just won our eighth Le Mans, which we're very proud of. Cadillac Racing, we also support GM with their IndyCar and NASCAR efforts. So that's really the backbone and kind of the core of our business. But we also get the opportunity to work on a lot of neat things in defense and automotive R&D and aerospace, power sports. So we get to take the knowledge base we develop in racing and do a lot of other neat things with it.
So you take the racing knowledge to these other industries. Does stuff feed back into racing, too, from them?
Yeah, you know, we're starting to see, we've taken those technologies and applied them, for example, in defense. We've been doing defense for about 7 years now, and now we're starting to take some of the technologies that we've been able to learn and develop in our defense vehicles and now apply them back to our racing programs. Things like, you know, collision avoidance systems and, you know, additional materials development and simulation development. So, yeah, we're starting to see the full cycle of you know, tech transfer.
Okay, we got a picture up on the screen. Oh, let's bring that back, Carmen. What the heck is this thing? It's a vehicle with no windows in it.
Yeah, so it's a little different than a race car. But what that is, it's we just finished a three-year project with TARDEC, which is the Army's R&D program for tanks and all things ground vehicles. And what that vehicle was designed for was looking at how can we protect our soldiers, you know, in the event of, you know, a bad event, say an underbody blast event. So this was a three-year development program where we worked with the Army and the different service branches to develop a ground vehicle solution built around the soldier to enable a soldier to walk out of an event with zero injuries and come back home. So that we learned a lot from a materials perspective, from a systems engineering perspective, and how do we develop technologies that can mitigate the blast impulse load and allow our soldiers to come home safely. So that was a really fun project. And again, another example of taking racing technology for survivability, performance, lightweight, and doing some goodness in defense. Mm.
It looks like eight-wheel drive, eight-wheel steering, too, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. So a little different than four-wheel, you know, so we had a chance to, you know, kind of multiply that by two. But that was pretty neat in that it's got, four-wheel steering, so we're able to have really tight turn circles, really good off-road mobility.
Electric in-wheel motors? Or?
This version doesn't. You know, okay. We did look at that. We looked at the entire trade space to say, okay, you know, what's the best driveline, you know, suspension, powertrain architecture to enable it. This version doesn't, but, stay tuned in the future.
If we could go back just a second, you mentioned collision avoidance, and I know you guys won an award for that. And a lot of it's from the rear. We think of collision avoidance as don't bash into the guy ahead of you, but talk a little bit about that, and how is that information presented to the driver?
Yeah, so again, using that as an example of technology we were able to take in defense. You know, situational awareness is big in defense. And so we were able to take a combination of radar technologies, machine vision technologies, and apply them to motorsports. And what we did with this solution was, the drivers have a lot of information, especially in the IMSA and the Tudor Series classes in Le Mans. You've got a lot of different classes that are competing for the same space on the racetrack. You know, you have LMP1 cars who are very, fast closing speeds, especially at night and in the rain. It's hard for the drivers to understand exactly what's going on behind them in those difficult conditions. So we're using technology and sensors to provide information to the drivers on a screen so that it can tell them, even if they can't see them with the camera, but via the radar, it can tell them what kind of car is coming up behind them, what the closing speed is, and then at the last minute, it'll show them what direction that vehicle is going to pass them on. So it's really just providing the driver with additional information so that they can focus on what do I need to do to drive the car at 100%.
Lynn, the race car development programs are generally season to season, very fast development. Last year's car is obsolete, versus the one you're working on. Production automotive programs are faster and faster, too. Looking at things like JLTV, which is the Army Hummer replacement, that program's been going on for 10 years. Is there a frustration from a outside design engineering company's perspective, such as yours, that, when you get into working with these guys, boy, things tend to move slow? Or is that just an outside perception of that?
No, you're exactly right. And I would say that the frustration really lies in the end user, the soldiers, the commanders that are out there in the field looking for new solutions, and they look at, how fast the automotive industry can create new products. And the defense industry is now looking towards the automotive industry and for small companies like us in motorsports to learn, how can we develop solutions faster for them? And that's why they're coming to companies like us and Roush Performance, for example, those companies that have a motorsports background. Mm. And that's where, we as a small business and, coming from the racing side of it are able to have such a presence and I think influence and impact in defense. So you're exactly right. There is a lot of frustration. It costs a lot of money the longer these development programs are.
Right.
So if we can help them, if we can help the industry as a whole, shorten that product development time in defense and get solutions out to our warfighters faster, it, helps bring our warfighters home and also saves the taxpayer money.
Isn't it part of it, though, skirting the normal procurement process, that is just a bogged down of paperwork?
It is. It's the procurement process. It's the requirements process. A lot of the bottleneck is in requirements. To generate an RFQ, you have to develop an entire list of requirements. What we're proposing is, give us the mission. You tell us what mission you need to complete, and we'll figure out what suspension, what drivetrain, what C4 system or situational awareness systems you need on it. Don't require those, don't specify them, but let the industry, come up with the solutions for you, because that's where a lot of the time is. And you hear about scope creep and a lot of these, the bomber and the fighter programs, and that's what's happening is, they're trying to dig down to very specific requirements instead of saying, what's it going to take? Provide me a solution that gets my soldier from A to B. Mm-hmm. So you're exactly right.
Is there a lot of bureaucracy versus working for like a General Motors in that regard? Layer upon layer of engineers, assistant engineers, engineering managers, et cetera?
On the technical side, our experience is that working on the technical side, the R&D arms with the program offices in defense, number one, they're very bright. They're very passionate about what they do, and they all want to make a difference, right? They all want to help our warfighters do their job better. I think where the bureaucracy comes in is really more on the procurement, the administrative side, to trying to get all the quality systems, to try and meet all those requirements. I think that's where, the bottleneck is. But, I will say that the services are trying to address that. We're hearing a lot about procurement and an acquisition reform. How do we make this more efficient? How do we get rid of this red tape and ultimately reduce cost?
Mm. Yep. Taxpayer love you guys.
Yeah, we're trying. We're trying, So it's, hopefully we're moving the needle in the right direction.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we got to talk about the elephant in the room, which is not an elephant whatsoever, but you brought a motorcycle along with you, and we got to talk about this, too. So what the hell is it?
Yeah, so that is, you know, that is a great American success story. This is a product of two guys, Lee Kahn and Brian Case out of Birmingham, Alabama, passionate sports enthusiast, motorcycle enthusiast. They wanted to build an American sports touring bike that could compete with the best that the Europeans, the Italians have to offer. And this is a result of a dream and a passion that they had. They wanted American muscle DNA in this motorcycle, so they came to Detroit. They enlisted ourselves along with some of our other motorsports partners, K-Tech, for example, who have also been involved in a lot of GM motorsports programs. And they say, you know, what can you do to develop, you know, an American sports touring motorcycle that has American DNA? You know, we want this thing to sound like a small, you know, Chevy small block. You know, we want to take the engineering knowledge base that you use to design and build winning Le Mans cars and build us a motorcycle that can compete with the best in the world. So that was a fun project. It was about a two-year R&D project. This motorcycle you're seeing here was the very first prototype. So this is a million-dollar prototype right here. But with the development of that motorcycle, they are now into production. So they're building about 20 of these motorcycles a month now, and they've got a distributor ship across the U.S., and they're selling these now. And and what's really impressive about these guys is they have developed a brand around Motus, you know, that kind of takes, again, the DNA of American muscle power, and it brings it to a two-wheel platform.
So Motus is the name of the bike.
Motus is the name of the company, and the MST and the MSTR is the model of the bike.
Yeah. Motus Sport Tourer R.
That's right. Yeah. Sport Tourer.
Tell us about this engine they made from scratch.
Yeah, you know, so I give those guys a lot of credit. You know, whoever would have thought that two guys, you know, in a small engine shop like K-Tech, you know, could come up and design and build their own engine from scratch. Again, they took the architecture of a Chevy small block, so it's got a 90-degree V4. You know, it's a pushrod overhead valve engine.
And K-Tech designed this?
They did the original manufacturing of the prototype engines, but Motus and their production partner then took that. And
so you're saying Motus designed the engine?
They did, yeah. They designed it along with K-Tech and, again, some partners. Again, it was their vision, but they enlisted the industrial and the engineering partners to do it. And they set up the manufacturing infrastructure. They had Mass Motorsports in Texas, set up an assembly line. They sourced casting partners, machining partners, and they have built about 200 of these engines that are now sitting in the warehouse and being installed in bikes. But
does it share the GM small block bore centers?
It does, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so it shares a lot of the architectural.
Did they borrow the pistons or anything to save a little bit of R&D?
Yeah, they didn't because it's a smaller package. Okay. You know, it's a 1,650cc package, so they weren't able to take the bomb components. You know, they looked at that. You know, they said, can we literally take, you know, the pistons and rods and stuff and use it? But they wanted to get into a small, compact, optimized package, so they weren't able to quite do that. But the architecture, and when you listen to the sound of this thing, I wish we could start it up for you, but we may have some video. It sounds exactly like a small block Chevy. It's really cool.
So is there any limit to what you guys can and can't do in terms of developing vehicles? We've seen military vehicles. We've seen the sport bike. We know the Corvette and the Cadillac program. Could you guys do unmanned aerial vehicle? Could you do, a marine vehicle?
Yeah, you know, it's, we often talk about, man, it's amazing how far we've come, you know, just from being a small motorsports company and doing the things we are like this. We are doing, unmanned robotic ground systems now, for defense. We're involved in doing a lot of cool automotive R&D programs, some autonomy programs for the automotive industry as well. And we're even doing stuff for NASA. We've got some parts that were built in our machine shop that are up in the International Space Station now. So,
Pratt Miller, that's cool.
Yeah.
Is there a Pratt Miller sticker inside there somewhere?
There's not a sticker, but there's a Pratt Miller part number on there, which we're very proud of. And it was kind of funny story, but it's amazing how many guys in the shop wanted to come by and physically touch that part, when they found out that this part's going to be sent up. But so it's really cool. It's, one, we're we're just super fortunate to get the opportunity and have customers that trust us to do this kind of stuff. You know, so it's a lot of fun. Again, to take that racing, you know, heritage that we, you know, have built and be able to apply and do so many other things. It's a lot of fun.
So what slice of your biz is non-automotive, and is that slice growing now?
Yeah, you know, motorsports is still the biggest segment of our business. It's about 60% of our total business, and then the remaining 40%, which is engineering services, is work in defense, automotive R&D, power sports, aerospace. But that is a segment that is growing the fastest because we are exclusive to General Motors and motorsports, and they have been a great long-term partner.
You guys also do race car setup simulation, right? Software simulation for going to different tracks.
Yeah, we do. You know, as part of our engineering and product development process, we have developed a lot of the engineering tool sets that enable that. You know, the design and the development of the race cars. If it's a solution that we can't find that's available commercially, that's when we invest and develop custom simulation tools to help us accelerate the product development process. You know, how can we do better, faster simulation to provide, you know, better solutions, better components, better systems in a shorter period of time?
In fact, what I've heard is your simulation for NASCAR is such that pick the track, pick the ambient temperature, and humidity. Let's say Darlington, it's 80 degrees, 70% humidity. The tires have got 20 laps on them. What's the temperature of the right rear? And you guys can spit up the answer pretty much.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. It's similar to, you know, what we've been able to do from a full vehicle to what we've been able to do with simulation. You know, just how accurate we're able to get, you know, and push the envelope of being able to model things that historically have been very difficult to model. Aerodynamics, tires, dampers, you know, those are things that are very difficult to model under all situations that we see on the racetrack. Tire modeling, as you mentioned, is another area that we've invested in heavily with our partners in GM, both on the modeling side but on the testing side as well. And then our partners, Michelin, for example, you know, they're a very strong part of that whole development effort. But you're exactly right. What that allows us to do is provide our teams, you know, with a solution set that can easily and quickly enable them to optimize performance of the car, especially.
So it comes off the trailer ready to run.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So it's really providing the teams, whether it's our internal teams or external teams, with a tool set that they can use to optimize performance better, faster, cheaper than anybody else.
And this being software developed in-house at Pratt?
Many of the software that is being used is developed in-house, and then some of it we also have industry partners that we work with to improve, and then sometimes we'll modify it, but we integrate their software into our product development process.
Like MSC's Adams, I'm thinking of, in
exactly.
The chassis area.
Yeah, yep. MSC has been a long-time partner of ours, using their Adams software to develop systems. And, you know, in return for that, you know, we're helping them improve their software and their portfolio of products that they offer as well.
So in your facility in New Hudson, right, Michigan, are there just rooms full of people sitting at terminals? I mean, you look at this and you think there's got to be a lot of guys cutting metal and fabricating and, you know, doing mock-ups and that kind of thing. But it sounds like you're getting into a lot of really high-end simulation. You're becoming a simulation specialist as well.
Yeah, it is. It's, you know, it's interesting. You know, we're about 260 people. About 150 of those are engineers, you know, the super geeky kind of engineer people, who, again, are doing amazing things in simulation, design, you know, structural analysis and optimization, you know. But then we've got those, you know, the fabricators and the composite layup specialists and the machinists, you know, that are really craftsmen. You know, so it's fun to put that mix together, you know, and when you have that, especially when our engineers are working very closely with our manufacturing staff and our race team staff, you know, good things can happen.
Yeah. So it sounds like if you're an engineer, a young engineer, Pratt & Miller would be a great place to get a job.
Yeah, you know, it's, I mean, who doesn't want to come work on, you know, race cars and motorcycles and
tanks.
Defense vehicles,
yeah,
you know, and tanks and stuff at NASA, right. You know, and then to be able to build the stuff, too. And I think that's where a lot of the satisfaction comes is, you know, you mentioned the product cycle time. You know, it's very short. You know, what we're able to offer our people, you know, our results, you know, very quickly, you know, so that they can come in and design something. And, you know, in a couple of weeks, months later, you know, we can start to build something.
Have you guys gotten much into the 3D manufacturing yet on that end of things?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah, 3D additive manufacturing. We have two RP machines right now, and that is an industry which is going to transform how things are going to be able to be designed and built. A lot of our race cars right now, we've got printed parts on them because we're only building, you know, 2, 4, 6 sets, you know, in total. So it's easier for us to just print those and use those on the car. So it's pretty interesting. Where
metal and plastic?
Most of it's plastic, okay. But we have some metal printed parts that we don't have in-house, but we've got relationships, again, with RP companies that do that as well. So
I still love telling the story of when I went to the Maker Faire a couple of years ago here, and I saw this display of high school students on a table about the size of a ping pong table with 3D printers, very simple 3D printers, making parts to make more 3D printers to be assembled and make more. And that's when my jaw dropped. I thought that's the future of manufacturing.
It's like iRobot kind of stuff. The robots are making robots, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, look, the music is a signal. We're going to be taking a commercial break. But, Lynn, stick around. We got a lot more to talk about here. And we also got to give a sponsor shout-out to our good friends at, and so that you're listening, our good friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. And we already got a question from one of our viewers. And, you know, we've talked so much about this bike. Jonathan, thank you, Jonathan, for the question. What are the performance stats?
So performance stats. So so this bike here, the MSTR, this is 180 horsepower, you know, out of a 1,650cc engine, about 130 foot-pounds of torque. And you can go to modusmotorcycles.com and get all the information. They've got a lot of different options that you can put on the bike, you know, for comfort or for performance. It says a lot of good information. You'll also get a sneak preview of some other products that are coming down the line in the future on that.
Has the motorcycle press weighed in on whether or not they managed to beat the Asian and the European and Italian competition?
Yeah, you know, they've gotten a lot of good press from the motorcycle magazines and that industry. So it's very positive so far. There's a backlog of orders. They can't, you know, get them out the door fast enough. So all indications are right now is that this is competing head-to-head with the best run.
How does the price compare?
You know, it's a very premium motorcycle. The MSTR is about $34,000, fully decked out, you know, with all the comfort trims and feature. You know, but this bike is, again, meant to go head-to-head with the best, you know. So it's competing in the same price point that the European and the Italian bikes are.
Are they at that price point?
Yes. Oh, yeah,
okay.
Yeah, fully loaded. But, again, go to modusmotorcycles.com and you can get more information.
M-O-T-U-S.
M-O-T-U-S, that's right.
Okay, Lindsay, you're a bike guy. What do you think?
I think it's great. I think it's a real alternative. Honda kind of proved out that transverse V Sport Tourer on their ST series. This engine has different torque characteristics. It's more like Lynn said, more of a kind of a deep throated small block kind of deal. It's lightweight. It's got a chassis. It's kind of like a Ducati. It's a trellis type chassis. It's got premium suspension, Ohlins front fork. I think probably an Ohlins rear suspension damper. Really high quality body. Work on it. I haven't ridden one, but I would love to try it. This bike looks great.
Well, you know, it's got to get back to the shop somehow. So Lindsay could take it back for you, Lynn.
I could.
There you go. It's it only cost $1 million to design and build that bike, but you know we
and I'll be hypothermic by the time I get over there.
That's right. That's right. But they do have a dealer network across the country, so and doing dealer drives. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. I encourage people to get out and ride one.
Mm-hmm. That's wild. The story you were telling of these two guys coming up from Alabama. Yeah. How did you get in touch? Are they in with you? And does a lot of business just sort of fall in your lap that way? Or how do you guys get these from military to motor racing to bikes to all the simulation software? I'm just curious about your business plan, how it all comes together.
Yeah, you know, a lot of it is from referrals and just networking. You know, people knowing what we do. I think the quality, you know, and the success rate that we've had in the motorsports programs. So a lot of people do come for that. You know, specifically Modus came to Detroit. They wanted to replicate, you know, what was done on the motorsports programs for, you know, big American iron and really wanted to get that American muscle DNA into the bike. And that's why they went to K-Tech for the engine development. They wanted to come to us for our chassis and suspension and mobility expertise. And we're starting to see that a lot. You know, again, I go back to defense. You know, they're coming to, you know, the motorsports companies and the smaller companies like us and, you know, Roush and people like that because they see what we're able to do in very short time with the level of performance and quality.
Yeah.
So it sounds like racing, from your perspective, is being injected into all of these industry segments. Go fast, get the job done right, and provide your customer a big service.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. You know, I mean, motorsports, you know, winning performance is in the DNA, right? It's in the culture of companies like us and other people here in the area. So a lot of people are coming, you know, to get that DNA injected into their product. You know, how do we, you know, make it lighter, faster, stronger, you know, and where, you know, what are the companies that we can go to get that?
Now, I always wonder, you know, one of my favorite moments every year of motorsports is waking up the second morning of Le Mans to see who's still standing. Turn it on the TV, and I just love that in-camera shot in the Corvette, wide open throttle, Mulsanne straight, that motor just singing. And I always think of not only Corvette, but you guys as well. And they'll show Gary Pratt in the pits and so forth. How many of you guys get to go on that junket?
Yeah, you know, it's fortunate. A lot of us have gotten to go. You know, I was there for the first time we, you know, entered Le Mans as one of the race engineers. You know, a lot of us have gotten older and grayer, and it's time to kind of pass the baton on to the next generation. But it's very special, and for us, it's very proud, you know, being able to represent America, being able to, represent Chevrolet and Corvette, you know, on a global stage. And, you know, to have the success that we've been able to have over there, you know, 8 Le Mans wins at 16 attempts, so that's a 50% win rate against the best, you know, Ferrari, Porsche, Aston Martin. You know, we're just very proud to represent the United States, to represent Detroit. You know, so it's pretty special, pretty emotional, especially this year. You know, after we lost one of our cars in qualifying,
very early on.
You know, a lot of you would think that the team on that car, you know, would pack it up, go to the hotel, start drinking beers or whatever. But everybody stayed on. The whole team stayed on to support the one bullet we had in our chamber. And it was pretty emotional to see how, you know, those teams rallied to support each other. You know, it was a team effort and that we got to get this car to victory lane in the top step, and it happened. So it was pretty emotional.
So what's your reaction to Ford coming in with GT, very purpose-built car?
Yeah, you know, that's exciting. And to us, again, to have more American presence there, you know, Dodge used to be there with the Viper, and that was a lot of fun to get to race them, kind of us representing the Europeans and some of the other manufacturers. We've been having to go solo for a couple years now, so it's going to be great having Ford come back in there, you know, to represent America, another strong American brand, and we're looking forward to the competition. We love the competition because it forces us to get better, so we love it. You know, really excited for them to come back on, and it's going to be
exciting. But do you feel they've got an unfair advantage? Very purpose-built car. It's a $400,000 car, you know, mid-engine. I mean, their whole thing to do this was to go to Le Mans and beat you guys and everyone else.
Yeah, sure. You know, we look at them just like we do any other competitor. You know, Ferrari's a mid-engine car. You know, Porsche, you know, is designed around a racing platform, but so is Corvette. You know, what we've been able to do with Corvette, you know, over the past 10 years is take a lot of the racing technology and knowledge transfer and build it into the production car. You know, we did that with the C5 into the C6, and now we're into the C7, and it's continuing to happen. So there's a lot of, you know, motorsports and racing performance DNA that's in the production Corvette. But we treat them just like any other competitor, and it's going to be a good battle. We're looking forward to it.
So when will you begin next season's development?
We're already doing that. You know, I think I can disclose it, but there has been some leaks of our past test at Sebring already. You know, obviously Ford has been out there testing their spec for the 2016, and so are the other manufacturers. You know, for us, it never stops, you know, so we usually start development of the next year's car very early in the year. You know, so we're always looking.
So you build a new car every season or a couple of new cars every season?
Yes, we build, depending on how many changes and how much development has gone into that car, if those development items are big enough that we need to change the architecture and the chassis, we'll go ahead and do that. Some years there are small developments that we can just do with aerodynamic modifications, you know, engine modifications, things like that. But we're starting that process very early, and it really never stops. You know, we're always looking into the future. Yeah.
How good is CFD, you know, computized, I think that's
computational
right.
Computational fluid dynamics.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How good is the correlation? Because, you know, we saw like an IndyCar this year. Honda came out with its package, was not really all that competitive. I got to believe you still cannot just simulate everything on the screen. You got to go in the tunnel.
Yeah, you can't, you know, you can't rely 100% on simulation. You know, and our approach to any development project is, you know, simulation is one tool in the toolbox. You know, we have simulation, we have scale model testing, we have full vehicle testing. You know, so we have a portfolio of development tools that we use, you know, one of which is simulation. You know, and depending on the type of simulation and the correlation confidence you have in it, is more you can use that tool. But for those maybe you don't, then you got to use other tools like wind tunnels or seven post shakers, you know, tire testing machines, things like that.
Hey, we got a few more questions here. Steve wants to know, what can you tell us about the lightweight Zora Corvette? Wink, wink.
I really can't comment.
I like that answer. I like when they say I can't comment. I thank you, Steve. Good question. Armin wants to know, an autonomous race car was shown earlier this year. What's your take on that? Is Pratt and, well, you've talked. You are working on autonomous technology, probably not for race cars, I imagine.
You know, it's interesting. So we're doing a lot in the autonomy space. We're doing a lot of autonomy work in defense. We have our own robotic platform that we're doing in defense. We're also doing a lot of R&D work in the automotive industry for customers doing autonomy. It's very interesting in that, you know, I mean, that's the future. You know, that's the future of transportation and mobility. You know, and I can say that, you know, if there are going to be autonomous cars out there, that somebody is going to want to say that my autonomous controller is better than yours.
So
we are going to see something out there, and it's very interesting. The XPRIZE Foundation actually put together a program, and maybe we can talk about that sometime.
We'll have to have you back.
Great. Thank you,
Lynn Bishop.
Much.
Thanks so much for coming on and telling us so much about Pratt & Miller.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be here.
Cool.
I'll put money on that Corvette against a big S7. Autonomous race car.
So we're off to, let me see.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, it's interesting. The XPRIZE is actually put together.
We need to go. Yeah. Okay. Hey, thanks again.
Thanks, Lynn.
A little chemistry goes a long way, especially when it comes to vehicle development. From enabling the use of alternate materials to withstanding extreme vehicle environments, Henkel's adhesive, sealants, and surface technologies provide solutions for every vehicle segment. Come see for yourself. Our Detroit area headquarters offers 12 research and development and testing laboratories with the ability to do full-range testing and validation on actual vehicle parts. Sign up to tour our labs at henkelna.com/tour.
And Henkel, thank you for your support of Autoline After Hours. Okay, let's get to some of the news that's been going on this week. No shortage of things. Some of the enthusiast media has gotten into the Acura NSX. Frank, I got to believe you guys at Motor Trend.
Yeah, my colleague Jason Camisa wrote, I think, the definitive 3,500-word piece on that car. And basically, he said it feels like a car that was made in Ohio. Like they were worried too much about it being an everyday supercar that wouldn't draw too much attention to itself, that would be easy to drive every day, and it's a little too accordy, you know, for a supercar, for people that are shopping against Huracans and
but
stuff like that.
But wasn't that kind of the original NSX, too? I always said, you know, my mother could drive that.
It was. And what he ended up saying in the end was that, you know, there's all these different modes. And when they finally tried it on the Track Plus mode or the top of the line one, it was great. And he's like, probably a little bit of that could be filtered into the other modes, or maybe there needs to be one more, you know, even, you know, wilder mode and drop the most staid one or whatever. But It was a lot of people have sort of had that, you know, kind of ambivalent, a little more ambivalence than I think they were hoping.
And I'm wondering, too, at this point, Frank, how much tuning they can still do. I mean, this is probably the most iterated vehicle project that we've all seen in the last,
As you guys know, they tore up the plans early on in the program and started
away a V10.
Five or 6 years. And I've heard they've had to rechip some of these subsystems, you know, and then you've got to get on NVIDIA's calendar and you've got to get them to, you know, repurpose a new chip, you know, for the rear suspension or for the torque vectoring system. This thing's very complex. I'm just wondering, you know, they gave you guys a drive and how much really adjustment they might be able to do.
Well, they've got kind of a lot of time left, and I think it's ones and zeros at this point. I think he felt like that there was quite a bit of bandwidth there, and he just wanted to maybe see a little different, differentiation of that bandwidth. So, because I think a lot of people are like, I would never put it in track plus mode unless I'm at a track, and I'm never at a track. So if it's great in track plus mode and it's kind of in the street modes, then maybe we need to move a few of those, you know, because like the steering felt a lot better in the track plus mode than it did in the other modes. You know, it's not unsafe to have good feeling steering. Let's move some of that. And I think it's probably wouldn't need new chips. I got the impression I got anyway.
Yeah.
Well, is part of it due to this complexity, Lindsay? You know, it's not just a straight internal combustion engine. It's got batteries. It's got electric motors. And, you know, everything's got to talk to each other. And of course, you know, we were talking about, you know, 24 hours of Le Mans earlier. That's the way the P1 class, LMP1, is all going. So, you know, I could see where Honda/Acura would want to get that in. But I wonder, is that part of where you're not picking up on this is
hypercar. The straight line performance was wonderful. You know, I don't think they need a ton of work there. I think it's just the tactile feel of the thing just needs to be a little more accessible than it is at the moment.
Yeah. They're moving a lot of power around in this car, not only with the chassis and the handling, but they're using the electrical system to fill in for turbo lag in the turbos. I mean, this is really kind of the holy grail of an electrified platform, is to be able to shuffle power around wherever you need it, including from the chassis to the engine. I mean, this is cool.
Yeah.
It is, but like you said, complicated, and maybe, like you said, they still have development time. Right. This isn't coming out till next year.
Exactly.
There's still more tweaking that can be done.
Right. Hopefully it's coming out then. I mean, the goalpost has been moved more than a few times.
It was supposed to be out this year, originally.
And Jason's piece was great, too. I just read it today. It was great. He did a great job.
Cool. Well, you know, speaking of Honda and Acura, Tokyo Auto Show going on. There's some wild and crazy stuff coming out there. Let's start with the fuel cell cars. Did they pass a law that fuel cell cars have to be ugly?
Right? You would think
this is better
so.
Than the Mirai, though, if you're talking about the Honda.
I know. This chair is better than the Mirai.
Right.
But even the Honda is like, that's not set.
Not nearly as attractive as
benchmarks.
The first.
Right. The first one was much better. Right. Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, when you first saw the first-gen Prius was very unconventional. And this philosophy that these alternative power vehicles have to attract your attention, BMW i3, I get it, okay? You're the different guy on the block that's got the, you know, the hybrid or the electric car. Start to mainstream this stuff now.
Tesla's done a good job, I think.
They've done a great job.
Tesla came out with a car that is absolutely a game changer.
Right.
But it still looks really good.
Yeah.
I don't like the grill, but that's enough.
Well, and the new Volt is more mainstream. And I'm surprised that the Japanese, you know, as Frank was saying with the first Clarity, it was pretty handsome car. And now they've kind of gone the other direction with this, my opinion.
Yeah, there's a little, I think there's some work to be done on styling inside Team Honda, generally speaking.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, NSX itself is kind of there's a lot of stuff going on when you look at that car. And from Jason's piece, color really plays a role in all these body lines and, you know, lines that are going this way and that. I mean, it forces you to look at it, but I think it's a color-intensive car, too, NSX.
What did you think of the RX Vision?
We've got a question here from Ron Paris, who wants to know if any of us think that Mazda will be developing a hybrid drive system for that RX Vision.
Well, now there would be a thing where
using the rotary engine in combination with electric motors
to fill in the torque, but there's that's never there. I suppose that would be a possibility. But that is a really huge dash to axle. Yeah. But the sides, that big scallop on the sides kind of didn't suit me too well.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, that the rotary keeps coming back. They can't escape this. You know, some of the engineering companies have done hybridized vehicles using little rotaries. I think FEV and AVL have used them. If you keep the rotary kind of running at constant speed, it doesn't have these transition emission kind of issues that when you're running from zero up to red line. So maybe as a prime mover, as an APU, the rotary still has a future? I don't know.
Instead of boing, 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 yeah, which exactly is great right. if yeah. you don't want to hear it, you know, yeah, you don't want to know it's there. Yeah.
Spool it up. Of course, it's got to spool up from zero, so you're going to be making some emissions, but get it to that sweet spot fast, and it's nice and light. It's small. You know, but emissions is the problem.
But, you know, Mazda had also talked about that if you're going to run hydrogen in an internal combustion engine, that the rotary is the best to use.
Right.
I don't know if that really makes any sense or not. No, Frank is shaking.
Well,
no.
They don't ever count as ZEVs because a little trace oil goes out the tailpipe. So what's the point? I think we closed the book on that with the 7 Series a while ago.
So what's this latest reiteration of the rotary all about then? Is it Mazda just can't let go?
I think they can't let go, really. They've had this program that continues and continues, and every time the media says the rotary's dead, you know, we're celebrating the last RX-7, RX-8, we find out that this thing, there's still two guys in Hiroshima that are working on this thing.
But, you know, you look at that car, and it doesn't fit any kind of architecture they have. That would be a from-scratch thing. A microscopic company, it just seems pretty unlikely.
And here's a picture of the car up there. Yeah, that is the longest dash to axle. And boy. But if you're a little company like Mazda is, and you've got all these emissions and safety and all this technology, why would you put all this money into developing a rotary engine that nobody sees a future in? I say nobody.
Well, I mean, did anyone open the hood and see if it drove out on the stage with the rotary going, or was this just, you know, it's a show car.
Right.
I mean, it could be anything.
Okay, another car that came out of the Tokyo show that I thought actually looked pretty good is this Nissan IDS.
I think it's a technology platform. They're looking just like Chevy is with the Bolt for 200-mile range from a battery EV.
Yeah, here we got a picture of it.
They've increased the battery from, I think, 30 kilowatt hours to 60 kilowatt hours, so they've doubled that, so we'll get about 200 miles. But the car's also carbon fiber intensive and so forth. I mean, could this be the next Leaf? There's some speculation. It's way beyond what the next Leaf will be. But our conversations about Leaf have kind of, you don't really talk about Leaf anymore. I mean, it needed the range. So I think this is a demonstrator for that.
Well, not only that, I think you hit on a key. I mean, the Leaf looks goofy. Let's face it. It really does. I think this car looks terrific.
Yeah. It has a resemblance to the rest of the family with that new C-pillar architecture and so forth.
Shape of the grill and all. Yeah, I see Maxima right in the grill.
Right.
No kidding.
And
actually,
I think it's a little better executed here than in some of the current production models. But
so what else?
Lexus. Oh. That thing was pretty interesting looking.
Oh, the LCLF?
Well, their LS, you know, predictor styling study.
But
I thought that looked kind of interesting.
A fuel cell car. Right. Another fuel cell
car,
right?
It is, yeah. They say, hey, don't, you know, look at the styling. This is what we're going to do with our next big, you know, flagship.
Yeah.
And I thought it looked, you know, kind of interesting.
Yeah.
They go away from the spindle grille? Or
the spindle
grille
is still in the front. They've got kind of the echo it in the back with the taillights and everything. But just especially the side profile, I thought looked pretty sharp for the way, you know, considering what a lot of Lexuses have looked like lately.
It kind of got LS back into the conversation because that's another car you forget about, that they even do the LS, you know?
Yeah. Well, sales of, you know, they're a trickle of what they were before. Right. Where was the car styled? Do you know, Japan?
California? I think so. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, what about we got to take another quick commercial break here. Well, I always got to do that. Got to pay these bills here. And so we're going to take a short one because we're going to give a shout out to our friends at Dodge.
We don't have to worry about predators like our ancestors did. No saber-toothed tigers stalking from the brush. No dire wolves circling the camp. There are no more monsters to fear. And so, we have to build our own.
Okay, we're back, and, you know, we've got this motorcycle in here. Yamaha showed what they're calling the Motobot, an autonomous motorcycle. What do you guys think about? Who would buy an autonomous motorcycle?
Well, I don't think it's an autonomous motorcycle. I think it's a robotic control system for, number one, testing motorcycles and these new safety systems. I mean, bikes now have yaw control. They've got very advanced stability control systems, ABS, et cetera. The videos I saw, the bike at the proving ground had outriggers, so it's set up to be a test mode. They've kind of configured, if you look at it, it's kind of like a computer on top of where the gas tank is. But they've connected the computer to mechatronics that can pull the clutch lever, shift gears. So there's a plastic structure that kind of connects the brain to these other things. They've done a great job of making it look like a rider. Mm. Will we be seeing MotoGP with robots? Probably not anytime soon. I think Yamaha is going to put that to use at their proving ground for two-wheel vehicle testing.
But didn't they come out and say that their goal would be to beat a GP rider?
They've got Valentino Rossi, who's been their factory rider for a long time, and so they kind of set him up. Can this beat Valentino, you know?
Yeah,
who knows?
That's just to get people talking. But like you say, this is to test safety systems, because when you're testing a brand new safety system, you don't want to send Valentino out there.
Yeah, right, that's right.
You know, you want some metal and plastic thing flying over the handlebars when something locked up that shouldn't have done. So.
And I think also this Motobot is kind of a shot back at Honda for Osimo. You know, Honda's really kind of made a lot of hay with this. Mm-hmm. And we've already seen examples of Osimo not looking like a humanoid, but on production lines and, you know, in these kind of environments. And so here's Yamaha saying, you know, hey, Honda, we can kind of do the same thing. And this is right in our wheelhouse with motorcycles.
Yamaha also had a sports car at the Tokyo show, didn't it? Had something else that it showed there as well.
I have not seen them.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a very interesting company.
Yeah. They've got a long history with Toyota. I mean, the 2000 GT and a lot of these programs, the show Taurus, they did the cylinder heads and that motor. So
the whole V8.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the later show, yeah.
Yeah. And I was out at LG Chem's battery plant last week in western Michigan, and a lot of these mini cell manufacturing systems that put battery plates together had the Yamaha logo on them. Mini transfer lines, belt-driven, that were moving plates and anodes and cathodes kind of along and fitting them into frames. Yamaha was branded within these cells.
Wow.
Who would have known it?
Right.
So they must have a manufacturing division as well.
Well, they've always been brilliant at manufacturing. I mean, right. And they make such a variety of things, from pianos.
Yeah, I know. Right. I know.
Okay, let's get into the politics of the week here. We had Donald Trump tweeting out like a madman how he had forced the Ford Motor Company to cave and pull all its stuff out of Mexico and build a huge plant in America to build cars. And, of course, none of it's true whatsoever.
Where's this huge plant? You know, I mean, their last investment was like a powertrain plant a few years ago. Boy, Ford's investment in the U.S. is astounding. It's huge. They've been in Mexico for years. You know, they started building Model Ts all over the world.
I want to say they've been in Mexico since the 20s.
Since the 20s, right. Don't get me going on.
He's never been one to let the facts get into the way of a good tweet and a good, you know, story line on his preferred news channel. So,
right.
I got to credit Ford because, you know, this is a delicate balance. You want to fight back when stuff is just made up out of whole cloth. On the other hand, it's very dangerous for anybody in a retail environment to get involved in anything political.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's a landmine. You're going to blow up in front of somebody.
Yeah.
His campaign might figure, too, we got nothing to lose in Michigan. You know, it's a union state. It's a manufacturing state. I'm a Republican. You know, are we going to lose a vote on going after Ford with this?
Well, you know, but to me, look, you can attack Ford for a lot of things. You shouldn't make stuff up.
Yeah, right.
I mean, and the one thing he can point to is, yes, Ford's now moving heavy truck production. The F-650 and 750 are coming out of Mexico. They're going to an existing plant, Avon Lake in Ohio. Right. That decision, by the way, was announced in 2011, well before Trump ever announced he was running for president.
He might have been a Democrat back then.
Yeah, I think he was.
That's right.
You know?
But that just sort of cracked me up that, you know, the guy's just making stuff up.
Right.
And, you know, I don't mind talking about politics as it impacts the automotive industry. Otherwise, I try to stay away from it on these shows, but... had to bring it up. Couldn't avoid
and
that.
I read recently, too, that that statistic that somebody in his campaign pulled up for him came from some obscure place, like a website no one had heard of. So it also gets into, you know, trusting everything on the web. You know, pull me up a statistic real quick that I can do this with. And, I mean, nothing was vetted at all. But that, I mean, if you see his rallies, I mean, I won't get into politics.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
So what else? What else are you guys interested in that's been happening lately?
Well, just to me, this whole autonomous thing that we talked about, Lynn, is just getting deeper, is moving faster. The technologies are going from big to small. You know, recently I was over at the GM Heritage Museum, and they had that first DARPA Challenge vehicle over there that won that, you know, Streets of DARPA, you know. And all of the sensor array, everything's big. You know, there's a bar across the top. Everything's huge.
It's bristling.
The 7,000-pound
Tahoe. It's a porcupine of sensors, and now all that stuff is so much smaller, and LIDAR units are coming down in size, everything's coming down in cost. Years ago, we were saying they won't be able to afford to put cameras on vehicles and radars, and it's just blowing me away.
Well, yeah, I was just at a luncheon previewing some things that'll be at CES, and one of the guys was saying and talking about how when you're making billions of smartphones, and the new smartphones have more and more accelerometers and cameras and sensors and so forth on them, that just drives the price of all that stuff down so low and makes it so accessible with so many other things.
Right.
Yeah, well, look, I've been talking about autonomy for decades now. I've been saying it's going to come here. Now it's finally happening. I think it's coming a lot faster.
Yeah,
than most
and one
people
of the things
think.
That they were talking about in this CES lunch, too, was the fact that we might see aftermarket autonomy. You know, these guys are saying it's not good enough. We can't just be content to wait until the however many zillion car fleet turns over. We need to maybe turn some of these other cars. And, you know, when you think about it, there's a lot of cars being built now and over the last 3 or 4 years that have a lot of the sensors you need. You'd need to add more. But it might be within the realm of something you stick inside the windshield that, you know, I mean, you could kind of see where that might happen.
I can't. I think you got to design a car from the get-go. I do think, though, that you could retrofit a lot of cars for connectivity and probably do it through your phone. So to your point, phones have accelerometers in them. You could, and they've got cameras in them. You could easily just plug it on top of the dashboard and have your own forward collision warning. Now, it may not apply the brakes automatically.
But it better not.
Yeah. But you know what? From what Frank's saying, it's absolutely true. Is if you want this to move forward fast, the car park has got to get smart. And right now, with vehicle ownership cycles, you know, extended, people are holding on to vehicles. You know, old, dumb vehicles won't move this thing forward. We've got to turn this technology over. And if it's not from the aftermarket, if you're going to hold on to your old car, you got to have to buy this from the aftermarket or buy a new car.
Well, the other thing is I attended a cybersecurity conference this week, too, and we're going to want those old, dumb cars come the cyber war when everything else
recently.
Gets bricked.
Right, that's right.
My sunbeam's going to work just as well as your signal one.
That's right. Yeah, you've got ignition points, and, you know, nobody can mess with your car with that technology.
I did put Fertronics in, but I keep the points in the glove box.
That's right. But, you know, one thing, too, interesting, you mentioned the IDS that was at Tokyo. You know, one thing that car has, I think, is a steering wheel that kind of folds back into the IP. And we're so used to that kind of tactile connection. And I think the more the industry kind of starts to get us wedded away from that, there's a trust factor, you know.
Wedded away from the steering wheel.
Wedding away from the steering wheel, right. The three of us have seen concepts with joysticks and so forth and so on, but there's still that kind of, you've got to rely on the old wheel there. And to do this, I think, was a psychological move forward for them. You get people thinking that maybe I'm not going to need this in the future.
Yeah, that really does point to a different point in this time where, you know, because I think right now, everyone still thinks autonomy is well and good while all the sensors are happy, but they want to reserve the right to say, uh-oh, I've gone offline, it's all you now. And whereupon you need to be facing forward, you know, hands near the steering
belted
wheel.
Belted
and all that stuff. And none of this turning our chairs around and talking to the people in the back seat like they're kind of suggesting what happened in that IDS.
Right,
you know.
Right.
So this is a whole different thing. But of course, the Google car that doesn't have a steering wheel, does it?
No.
It doesn't.
Oh,
you're right.
The first prototypes did not. I understand that they are now adding them.
No.
Because there are a few situations, you know, where you got to pull around behind the garage or something like that, where you're not in the cloud, that you've got to be able to steer it.
Yeah.
But I tell you, these semi-autonomous cars scare the hell out of me. Mm. The fact that I might be in a situation that I have to retract the steering wheel from its parked position, you know, that doesn't work when I'm going over the cliff right now. You know, I got to grab it right now. And to tell people, okay, now you can snooze. Oh, now you better get up and be. That scares the hell out of me.
Yeah.
Versus a fully autonomous car from the get-go with no pedals or wheels to steering wheel to begin with.
I think, and you go on the internet, there's citation after citation from law firms that are looking at this transitory period that you're talking about. You leave your house, you drive the car to the freeway, and then you go from level 1 to level 4 on the freeway. But who wakes you up on the freeway if you're into reading or you're not really paying attention? The car's pretty much driving itself. You go off the freeway to go into city streets and so forth. That's the point where I think the gray area between the auto industry and the grid, you know, is going to come into play. And who's responsible for that? Is it the OEM? Is it the system supplier? Is it who is it if you're not paying attention?
Well, look, if the car company said, okay, you can put it in autonomous mode and now it's going to drive on its own and you get in an accident, they're at fault,
not you.
Right, right. The liability is going to move from the individual operator to the manufacturer. And the manufacturer is probably going to turn around and hand the bill to the supplier that made the sensor that failed.
Right, that's right, right, right. So that whole thing is interesting, but I agree. It's this kind of move up from automated to autonomous, from level 1 to level 3, that's going to be the gray area for this.
Well, the way I think it's going to be introduced is it's probably going to start out with Google in a 10-mile radius of Mountain View, California, where its headquarters are. And it's going to be geofenced, and it will only operate on streets with 25-mile-an-hour speed limits. And then they'll take that from Mountain View, and they'll go through the whole Bay Area, and then they'll go to Austin, Texas, and Minneapolis, and New York. And
Ann Arbor,
and roll it out that way. And that's how I think Apple's going to do the same thing. That's my opinion. I do believe they're designing their own car. I don't think they'll manufacture it. They'll probably turn it over to Magna to manufacture. Mm. But I believe they're getting into this whole autonomous mobility services thing. And they're not going to have Apple stores with acres and acres of their cars on the lot. They're not going to do it that way. I think they're going to have you whip out your smartphone and call the Apple car just like you call Uber, and Apple's going to try to give you a different experience than what Uber will give you.
So you don't think, John, that it'll be like Apple Inside? You don't think it'll be them licensing that to Ford and Toyota?
No, I don't.
No, I think they see Elon playing with cars, and they want to play with cars, too.
But you know, they see Elon playing with cars, and he's not making any money. And, I mean, they're burning cash fast. So, you know, Apple never makes anything, right? They contract manufacture it. That's what I would expect them to do with their car. And, you know, look at Google. You know, they needed a car built. What do? They ran to Roush, you know. It'd be great
Pratt
to get
Miller.
Yeah, Pratt and Miller. We got to get Lynn back here, you know, because I know those guys have got to be working on something too.
Right, right. Yeah, interesting stuff. Interesting times right now.
It really is. Well, anything else burning that you got to talk about right now?
Can't think of it.
Yeah. Look, probably a good time to wrap things up. Oh, wait, Chip's handing me a sign here. Tell Youngblood Lynn cannot comment on his phone call question. Okay, sorry, Youngblood. But I want to thank you both for coming here. Frank Marcus, Motor Trend Magazine, everybody go out and read that article.
Yeah,
NSX.
Right.
It's the definitive article. Frank's right.
Cool. And Lindsay Brooke, where can everybody read your stuff?
Always good to see you. Join the SAE. SAE.org.
There you go. Okay. Yeah. I want to thank all you guys and thank all of you who have tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Dodge. and by Henkel. Excellence is our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.